It was December 2011 in Stockton, California. The temperature was mild, hovering around 60 degrees, a quiet reprieve from the winter chill experienced in most northeastern parts of the United States. Stockton, a city with its share of struggles and resilience, was about to face a tragedy that would haunt its residents for years to come. It began with a call that no one ever wants to make.
911, what's your emergency?
There's something on the floor in the bathroom, the voice trembled, and I think it's a body. I can see a foot. It has a sock on it, but there's no face. What started as an eviction notice turned into a horrifying discovery. Inside an unassuming downtown Stockton apartment, months of mystery unraveled in an instant. The apartment stood on a nondescript block, blending into the cityscape with its beige brick facade and faded trim. The air was cool and still, but an eerie silence seemed to hang in the atmosphere, as though the city itself held its breath. The streets were quiet, save for the occasional car driving past, oblivious to the gruesome secret within. As Eric, the apartment manager, stepped into the studio apartment, an overwhelming odor immediately filled the air. Each step he took toward the bathroom intensified the unmistakable smell of bleach mixed with the sickening stench of decay. Then he saw it, a shape on the bathroom floor, just inside the door. At first, Eric thought it couldn't possibly be human. But as he drew closer, the horrifying truth came into focus. The lifeless body of what appeared to be a woman lay before him, positioned on her back, with knees slightly bent and legs apart. Eric could make out a foot closest to the door, but when he looked to see her face, he was shocked to find that there was none. Instead, in its place, was what he would describe as a deeply embedded shoe print. The severe state of decomposition and the unmistakable marks of torture told a chilling story of pain and suffering. It quickly became evident. This wasn't just a murder. This woman had endured unimaginable torment before her life was cruelly taken. Hello, and welcome to today's episode of Sleuthy Stories. If you're new here, this is the podcast where real-life mysteries unfold, one clue at a time. The audio for today's story has been pulled from my main YouTube channel and remastered for this podcast experience. If you'd like to see the visuals that accompany this case, head over to my YouTube channel, Sleuthy Lucy. But for now, sit back, listen closely, and let's unravel the mystery together. Thanks for being here. Hello, and welcome back to the Sleuthy Stories podcast. I'm really glad you're here with me today as we step into another case, one that deserves to be heard, remembered, and understood far beyond the headlines. Today, we're going to Stockton, California, a city that, like many others, is full of everyday people trying to piece their lives together. Veronica Jones was one of those people. A mother, a sister, a woman with deep wounds from a troubled past, but a heart full of determination to do better. She was working hard to rebuild her life and regain custody of her child. But just as things were starting to look up, Veronica vanished. For months, her family pushed for answers. For months, there was silence. And then, something unthinkable was discovered. This case stands out not just because of the brutality of the crime, but because of how easily Veronica's disappearance could have been ignored, how quickly her story could have been dismissed. It forces us to ask hard questions about who gets attention, who gets justice, and who gets left behind. So let's take a closer look. Not just at what happened, but at everything that led up to it. Before we continue, I want to take a moment to thank the sponsor of this episode, who helps make it possible to share stories like Veronica's, Aura. a comprehensive service that protects you and your loved ones from those who wish to exploit your trust online. Ever get one of those strange text messages from USPS saying they have a package for you? Click this link to confirm. USPS never sends those types of messages. That's spam from scammers who likely got your information from a data broker or a leak on the dark web. Do you know how much of your personal information is out there? Your full name, phone number, home address, email, even details about your relatives can be sold to scammers, like the ones behind that USPS text message. That's why I turned to Aura. Aura not only monitors your information on the dark web, but it also automatically sends opt-out requests to data brokers on your behalf. It has helped me remove my information from over 18 data brokers and even alerted me that one of my email addresses was found on the dark web. With Aura, I also enjoy features like antivirus, VPN, password management, and identity theft insurance, all in one affordable package. If you sign up through my link right now at aura.com/sleuthylucy, Aura will give you a 2-week free trial. For a more direct route, click the link in the description below. Now let's dive in. December 4th, 2011, began like any other day for Eric, the apartment manager of Julian Apartments in downtown Stockton. Tasked with overseeing an eviction of a problematic tenant, he unlocked the door to inspect the unit. The air inside was thick and heavy with an odor of bleach and rot so overwhelming it stopped him in his tracks. With each step toward the bathroom, the stench grew stronger. When he finally reached the door and pushed it open, he froze. Just inside the bathroom on the floor was what appeared to be a body. The sight was so unsettling, so surreal, that he questioned whether it could even be human. From the state of the remains, it was clear they had been there for some time. Whatever, or whoever it was, had no face. As the initial shock began to fade, the horrifying truth settled in. It was indeed a person. The manager immediately called 911, and within minutes, law enforcement arrived at the 500 block of East Channel Street to secure the scene. The officers, already aware of a months-old missing persons case, entered the third-floor apartment with a feeling it might be her. Inside, they found the body of a woman lying on her back, on the bathroom floor adjacent to the bathtub. Her feet were towards the bathroom door, her head dismembered. She was wearing a red top, which was pulled up under what appeared to be her chin. Laundry and a partially torn Bible were on top of her body. The severe state of decomposition pointed to months of neglect, and the marks on the body told a horrifying story of violence and torture. She had suffered multiple stab wounds, impalement with a broken mop handle, still lodged inside her body, and extensive blunt force trauma. Though no formal identification had yet been made, deep down, the officers felt they already knew the answer. From the context clues, the officers quickly pieced the tragedy together. The body found in that specific apartment, a woman's belongings scattered throughout, and the severe state of decomposition all matched the timeline and details of a missing persons report filed months earlier. Still, the officers knew better than to jump to conclusions. It was essential to follow proper protocol and let the evidence speak for itself. Linking cases or making definitive statements without proof could jeopardize the investigation. The officers were handling this as a homicide investigation, but it was too soon to say definitively if this body was the result of homicide. Stockton police remained cautious, refusing to publicly confirm any connection to the missing woman, Veronica Jones, until the body was positively identified. Forensic experts would need to verify the identity and determine the cause of death before any official statements could be made. Despite the uncertainty, one thing was clear. This was no ordinary discovery. The condition of the body and the circumstances of its concealment painted a chilling picture. If this was indeed Veronica Jones, her family's worst fears were about to be confirmed. That night, the grim discovery dominated local headlines. News reports of a badly decomposed body found in a Stockton apartment quickly spread across TV screens and newspapers, capturing the attention of the community. For most, it was just another tragic story in a city that had seen its share of hardship. But for Isaac Zuniga, it was a moment of devastating clarity. When he heard the body had been found in the same apartment building where his sister had lived, his heart sank. He didn't need confirmation to know. It had to be Veronica. After seeing the news, Isaac immediately reached out to the police, desperate for more information. While no formal identification had been made, the investigators shared the devastating update he had feared all along. The investigators admitted they were 99% sure the body was his sister's. For Isaac, even without formal confirmation, it was enough to accept what his heart already knew. The body was his sister, Veronica Jones, the 35-year-old mother who had disappeared 6 months earlier. Veronica Jones was born on December 2, 1976, in Tracy, California. She was the youngest and only girl among four siblings. Life was anything but easy for Veronica and her brothers. Her two oldest siblings were in and out of foster care, while she and her brother David lived with their father. Things appeared to be stabilized for a while, but when they were kicked out by their father, Veronica and David found themselves in children's shelters. It wasn't until later that the four siblings were finally reunited under one roof after their mother petitioned the court to bring Veronica and David home to join their older brothers, Smokey and Isaac. Veronica's childhood was marked by instability, hardship, and a longing for the stability she never truly experienced. These early challenges shaped her journey in ways that would follow her into adulthood. Despite her struggles, Veronica was a fun-loving person with an infectious energy. Her brother Isaac recalls her bright personality and her love for others, especially her family, even as she wrestled with the weight of her insecurities. Isaac said she never realized just how beautiful she was, inside and out. Veronica struggled with anxiety and was diagnosed with bipolar disorder as an adult, challenges that profoundly shaped her life. Her romantic relationships with men, though often entered with hope, frequently left her feeling unfulfilled. She moved in and out of relationships, most of them fleeting, failing to stand the test of time. She searched for love, but found it difficult to believe anyone truly cared for her. Veronica battled many personal struggles throughout her life, one of which was an addiction to gambling. It became a habit that consumed both her time and her limited resources, pulling her into a cycle that was difficult to break. She frequently traveled by Greyhound bus from Stockton to Carson City, Nevada, a journey she made at least once a month. For Veronica, the casinos in Carson City offered a temporary escape from her reality. The flashing lights, the sounds of slot machines, and the bustling energy of the gaming floors seemed to bring her a fleeting sense of happiness. These trips, however, came at a cost. What began as a distraction quickly became a compulsion, one that added to the challenges Veronica faced as she tried to rebuild her life. While the casinos may have given her brief moments of joy, they couldn't fill the deeper voids she struggled to overcome. After giving birth to her last child in 2009, Veronica's life began to take a turn for the better. Determined to create a brighter future, she made significant changes. She entered rehab, joined support groups, and worked tirelessly to rebuild her life. Her ultimate goal was to reunite with her children, starting with her 2-year-old son, who had been placed in foster care. Veronica had 9 children, most of whom were raised by family members or placed in foster care, a heartbreaking reflection of the instability she endured during her own tumultuous upbringing. Her brothers recall that she was never truly taught how to love, nurture, or protect her children in the way they needed. Beneath it all was a deep-seated feeling that she was unworthy of love, a wound that stemmed from the rejection she experienced from the very people meant to protect and guide her. That rejection shaped her life, setting her on a relentless search for unconditional love, a love she often sought in all the wrong places. She believed that if she could be more successful, more beautiful, or something more than who she was, she might finally be accepted and cherished. By the time she entered her 30s, her brother said, Veronica felt adrift, lost, profoundly alone, and carrying the weight of trying to fill a void that had been left unfilled since childhood. But somehow, Veronica managed to recognize how history was repeating itself, and despite her struggles to see her own worth and believe in her beauty as a person, she found the determination to break the cycle. Her focus became reconnecting with her children. She started with her youngest child, attending court-ordered visitations and making steady progress toward her goals, fueled by a desire to give her children the stability she had always longed for. It was during this time, at one of her support group meetings, that she met Devin Omar Epps. Devin was also on his own journey of recovery, grappling with mental illness from an early age. Over coffee, the two found solace in each other, bonding through their shared struggles and experiences. Their relationship progressed quickly, and within weeks, they moved into an apartment together, hoping to build a stable life together. They were deeply in love and seemed inseparable, wanting to spend every moment together. Their apartment wasn't much. It was in a less than ideal area. But for Veronica, it represented a step in the right direction, a chance to build the stability she had long yearned for. After years of chaos and instability, she and her family finally felt she was on the right path. Her brother Isaac also found some solace, believing that Veronica had finally entered a healthy relationship. Of all her past partners, he said Devin was the best she had ever been with. Determined to heal, Veronica and Devin worked together to confront their pasts, overcome their struggles, and create a brighter future that included Veronica's children. But that hope came to an abrupt and devastating end. When Veronica failed to show up for her child's visitation and couldn't be reached on June 26, 2011, alarm bells rang. It was a quiet summer Sunday afternoon on June 26, 2011, when Isaac Zuniga's phone rang. The voice on the other end was unfamiliar, a woman who introduced herself as a social worker from California Child Protective Services. Her tone was serious, and her words immediately unsettled him. She explained that his sister, Veronica, had missed her court-ordered visitation that day with her two-year-old son. Veronica had been attending these weekly appointments without fail for the past 10 months. But today she hadn't shown up, nor had she called to explain her absence. The social worker's concern was clear. This was completely out of character for Veronica, a mother who had worked hard to maintain contact with her child. Now that same concern began to weigh heavily on Isaac, who had always stayed in close contact with his sister. Isaac's first instinct was to call Veronica. He dialed her number, but each call went unanswered. As he thought back, a realization struck him. He hadn't spoken to Veronica in over a week. Alarmed, Isaac reached out to other family members, hoping someone else had heard from her. But no one had, and for a woman who always kept in touch, this was deeply unsettling. In that moment, Isaac knew something was wrong. Veronica's sudden disappearance, her missed appointment, and the silence that followed were more than unusual. They were alarming. Somewhere, somehow, something had happened to his sister, and Isaac's mind raced with fear and questions he couldn't yet answer. Desperate for answers, Isaac reached out to Veronica's boyfriend, Devin, hoping he could provide some clue about her whereabouts. When Isaac got Devin on the phone, he asked if he knew where Veronica was. Devin responded that he hadn't seen her and speculated that she might have left him for another man. "What?" Isaac replied. Isaac found this response both surprising and strange. From his perspective, Veronica and Devin's relationship seemed strong, and now, for the first time, he was hearing that she might have left him for someone else. This didn't make sense, nor did the idea that she would simply vanish without a word, especially when she had been so focused on getting her life back on track. As Isaac spoke with Devin, he began piecing together what might have happened in the days leading up to Veronica's disappearance. According to Devin, the afternoon of June 25th was marked by tension and frustration, particularly involving a neighbor named Chris, who lived downstairs in their apartment building. Chris and Veronica were friends who occasionally spent time together, even doing laundry side by side. Devin explained that he had never liked Chris. He claimed Chris was always hanging around and seemed overly interested in Veronica, often looking at her in ways that made him uncomfortable. According to Devin, that afternoon, when he and Veronica went to the park, Chris had tagged along. At some point, Chris mentioned he was hungry and wanted to get a sandwich. Veronica, always generous, offered to buy it for him and asked Devin for money. Devin was furious. "Hell no," he told Isaac. "He can buy it with his own money." According to Devin, this sparked an argument between him and Veronica. She didn't like being told no, and the disagreement escalated. Devin said Veronica spent the rest of the afternoon at the park avoiding him, choosing to spend her time with her friend Chris instead. Devin said the last time he saw Veronica, she was walking off with Chris, leaving him behind. Isaac was bewildered by Devin's story. However, when he spoke with his brother David, the pieces began to fall into place. David had also been at the park that day and witnessed much of what Devin described. He recalled hearing Veronica and Devin argue over money for the sandwich. Devin, insistent on controlling the situation, refused, leaving Veronica visibly upset. Frustrated, she eventually walked away with Chris. For Isaac, this raised even more questions. Could Devin's account be true? As he thought about things, Isaac recalled that the last time he had seen Veronica, something had seemed a little off about her. Could she have fallen back into old gambling habits or been experiencing a mental health episode? Her struggles with mental health had been exacerbated by stress in the past, especially after their mother's death, which Veronica had taken particularly hard. Isaac couldn't help but wonder, had the pressures of her relationship with Devin, combined with her own internal struggles, pushed her to a breaking point? Now that she had gone completely silent, Isaac feared something was seriously wrong. The more he pieced together, the stronger his sense of dread became. Eager to find the truth, Isaac's wife decided to reach out to Devin herself. She called his cell phone, hoping he might reveal something he hadn't shared before. But Devin's response was the same. He said he hadn't seen Veronica in the last 2 days. The last time was at the park. It was now June 27th, after the mandatory 24-hour waiting period had passed. Isaac was finally able to file a formal missing persons report. With still no sign of Veronica, every attempt to track her down led to another dead end. With growing concern and nowhere else to turn, they decided it was time to involve the police. It was a step they had hoped they wouldn't need to take, but with no sign of Veronica and their fears mounting, they knew they had to act before it was too late. So Isaac went to the Stockton Police Department to report her missing. Isaac provided everything he could: her address, her boyfriend's name, and the alarming detail that she had missed a family birthday party on June 25th, something she never would have done. He told the officers about Chris, the neighbor, and the last time Veronica was seen in the park. Yet, the officers seemed disinterested, saying, "It's not a crime, for a 35-year-old person to be missing, and Veronica has a right to disappear and not tell anyone. This wouldn't be the last time Isaac would approach the police about Veronica's disappearance. Time and time again, his efforts to escalate the matter were met with reluctance. For reasons he couldn't understand, the police seemed hesitant to treat her case with the seriousness it deserved. Despite their initial resistance, Isaac's relentless pressure eventually prompted the detectives to finally take action. When asked about Veronica's history, Isaac admitted she had struggled with a gambling problem in the past, not illicit drugs or anything like that. Disheartened by their response, Isaac began to suspect that Veronica's history, her mental health challenges, her sometimes unannounced gambling trips, and even her neighborhood was coloring their perception of her case. He feared the police were less inclined to treat her disappearance with urgency because of these biases. Frustrated and angry, Isaac requested a welfare check at Veronica's apartment. The officers eventually went to the unit, but found no one home. They left a note on the door, asking Devin to contact them upon his return. As they were leaving, the detectives ran into one of the apartment managers, Leslie, and asked if she had seen Veronica. The manager replied that she hadn't seen her in quite some time. The detectives then asked about Chris, Veronica's neighbor downstairs. The manager confirmed that Chris lived on the first floor and corroborated Devin's story, that Chris and Veronica were friends. But her additional comments raised new concerns. The manager described Chris as someone with a questionable reputation. According to her, Chris often had women coming and going from his apartment. On multiple occasions, women had screamed for help, claiming they were locked inside his apartment until authorities intervened. "Are you saying he was holding them against their will?" the detective asked. "Yes," the manager replied. The manager went on to say that the last time she saw Veronica was on the day she went missing. She had been with Chris. After speaking with the apartment manager, detectives knocked on Chris's door. When he answered, they told him they were looking for Veronica Jones. Chris claimed he hadn't seen her since Saturday. "Saturday around 4 o'clock, Chris explained. "We had just come back from the park." He admitted that Veronica had come home with him that afternoon, but insisted they parted ways on the stairs. Chris quickly suggested the detectives were questioning the wrong person. He pointed out that Veronica and Devin had been fighting at the park earlier that day. According to Chris, Veronica had been very upset, telling him she was done with Devin and planned to catch a bus to Oakland. The detectives were skeptical. Had Veronica actually left Devin and taken a bus to Oakland, or was Chris trying to mislead them? They confronted Chris about the building manager's claims, particularly about his troubling history with women in the apartment. Chris didn't deny it. He admitted that many women came in and out of his apartment. "Yeah, I might let things get a little out of hand sometimes, but that doesn't mean I did anything to Veronica," he replied. Despite his attempts to downplay the situation, the detective's suspicions of Chris grew. They asked to search his apartment, and Chris agreed. Inside, the apartment was cluttered. Dirty clothes and dishes were scattered everywhere. But there was no sign of Veronica. The disarray suggested the space hadn't been recently cleaned, making it unlikely that Chris had covered up a crime scene. Leaving the apartment, the detectives headed to a nearby bus station to follow up on Chris's claim that Veronica planned to go to Oakland. The bus company's staff recognized Veronica from her photo and confirmed that she occasionally rode the city line. However, the clerk at the front desk said she hadn't purchased a bus ticket recently, at least not at the counter. It was possible Veronica had used the kiosk to purchase her ticket, so detectives requested transaction records from the bus company to investigate further. They also reached out to Veronica's brother, Isaac, who confirmed that while Veronica wasn't a stranger to hopping on a bus, Oakland seemed like an odd destination. "She doesn't know anyone in Oakland. Her ties are in Carson City, Stockton, and Fairfield, not the Bay Area," Isaac said. With no evidence to confirm Chris's story, and no sign of Veronica at the bus station, the mystery of her disappearance deepened. When the detectives updated Isaac about Chris's claims, Isaac immediately voiced his doubts. To him, Chris's account felt like a deliberate attempt to divert attention away from himself. Isaac's suspicion prompted detectives to dig deeper into Chris's background, and what they found only heightened their concerns. Chris had a long history of violence and sexual offenses. His record included multiple charges for indecent exposure, arrests for assault and battery, and even a restraining order stemming from domestic violence. With a past like that, detectives began questioning whether it was truly a coincidence that Chris was the last person seen with Veronica. Could Chris's story about Veronica leaving for Oakland be an attempt to cover his tracks? Or was he simply another thread in a tangled web of unanswered questions? Chris's rap sheet was extensive, painting a troubling picture of his past. While the domestic violence restraining order against him wasn't filed by Veronica, his history alone prompted detectives to believe he deserved further scrutiny. The detectives reached out to Chris, asking him to come down to the station to make a formal statement. Surprisingly, he agreed. At the station, the detectives confronted Chris about his criminal record. This time, however, Chris wasn't as cooperative as he'd been before. His demeanor was smug, his confidence unsettling. The detectives pressed harder, hoping to crack his composure. But Chris stood his ground, refusing to give them anything useful. As the interrogation wore on, Chris finally made a bold and bizarre statement. "Fuck no, I ain't gonna let you take me to jail. You can't charge me with murder. And if you did, I could beat it. I was the closest one to her." Christopher also told police that Devin had suggested he have sex with Veronica because both Devin and Veronica liked him and knew that he was single. However, Christopher stated that he did not engage in any sexual activity with Veronica. Chris told detectives that after seeing Veronica's picture on the missing persons list, he wasted no time heading straight to Devin's apartment, shouting angrily from outside the door. "Where's Veronica? We were just doing laundry together a few days ago." Devin never opened the door. Instead, he stayed silent, listening to Chris's accusations from the other side. As detectives wrapped up their interview with Chris, he made another comment that left them momentarily stunned. "Is that enough to convict Devin?" he asked, his tone laced with curiosity. The question seemed out of place, raising more questions than it answered. Was Chris genuinely trying to help the investigation, or was he attempting to deflect attention away from himself? With Chris's strange comment lingering in their minds, detectives couldn't ignore the possibility that more secrets were yet to surface in this tangled case. His erratic comments and behavior only added to the growing tension surrounding Veronica's disappearance. For the detectives, the pieces of the puzzle weren't coming together, but they couldn't shake the feeling that Chris knew more than he was letting on. Not long after speaking with Chris, the detectives received a report from the bus station. The records confirmed that someone had purchased a ticket to Oakland through the kiosk using cash, but because the ticket was purchased with cash, there was no way to verify if it was actually Veronica who had bought it. This frustrating dead end left detectives with no solid leads to pursue. With no new evidence and the case still classified as a missing persons investigation, the sense of urgency began to fade. To the detectives, Veronica was an adult with a history of mental health challenges and a known tendency to take spontaneous bus trips to other cities. From law enforcement's perspective, it was entirely plausible that Veronica had left her boyfriend and disappeared on her own. But Veronica's family saw it differently. They were convinced something far more sinister had happened. The family was understandably dissatisfied with the investigation. In their eyes, the detectives had failed to handle Veronica's disappearance with the seriousness and urgency it deserved. Frustrated by law enforcement's lack of urgency, Veronica's family decided to take action themselves. They began plastering missing posters across Stockton, focusing on places she frequented, hoping someone might come forward with information. They also left flyers with Devin. Their efforts were relentless, driven by fear and love. But as the days stretched into weeks with no new leads, their desperation only grew. For Veronica's family, giving up wasn't an option. But with no answers and little help, the weight of her disappearance began to take its toll. As the months dragged on with no progress in Veronica's case, Isaac began to suspect something more troubling at play within the Stockton Police Department. Detectives repeatedly told him they lacked probable cause to obtain a warrant to search Veronica and Devin's apartment. According to Isaac, much of this reluctance stemmed from Veronica being labeled a transient. The police seemed to believe she was bouncing between Oakland and Carson City, seeing her as someone who simply didn't want to be found. As far as the police were concerned, Veronica's decision not to contact anyone wasn't a crime. They appeared to view the situation as someone voluntarily disappearing rather than a potential foul play scenario. Meanwhile, Veronica's disappearance was clearly affecting Devin as his behavior became increasingly erratic. His behavior began to spiral, worrying neighbors in their apartment building. Residents reported hearing Devin screaming, banging furniture, and making loud, chaotic noises at all hours of the day and night, saying, "Now you bitch. Now what do you got to say, bitch? Now how do you feel? Didn't I tell you? I'll fuck you up. Keep it up, bitch. I said shut the hell up. You wouldn't listen." The disturbing part? It sounded as though he was fighting with Veronica. But Veronica had been missing for months. Devin's outbursts became more frequent and erratic. When anyone knocked on his door, he refused to answer. The shouting would wane for a while, and then it would start up again, only louder. His relentless ranting and raving reverberated through the apartment building at all hours, creating an atmosphere of constant turmoil. Some tenants questioned whether Devin was on the verge of a complete breakdown. The situation grew so bad that the apartment manager, Eric, finally decided enough was enough. Devin's bizarre behavior and relentless disturbances had made him a long-standing problem in the building. On the afternoon of December 4th, 2011, Devin returned home from a brief outing to find Eric waiting for him outside the apartment. Eric handed Devin an eviction notice, barring him from entering the apartment. "You're kicking me out?" Devin asked. Eric's response was firm. "There have been too many complaints. We can't allow this anymore," Eric said. With tensions boiling over, Devin was now officially evicted, setting the stage for what would come next. The confrontation between Devin and the apartment manager took a sudden and chilling turn. Devin began screaming, his voice echoing through the hallway. "You don't understand," he yelled. "She's in there. Veronica's in there." The manager was taken aback. Veronica had been missing for 6 months. What could he possibly mean? "Who's in there?" asked the manager. "Veronica. She's in there," Devin said. Devin's erratic behavior escalated as he began yelling and cursing, making a shocking statement that left the manager stunned. Devin claimed someone had set him up and jumped him, repeating the accusation over and over. "They beat her real bad," he said, his voice cracking. Devin's statements grew increasingly disturbing. He claimed that Veronica had been in the apartment for an extended period, days, weeks, or possibly even months, and that she hadn't eaten during that time. "She can't eat because she doesn't have a face," Devin said, repeating the haunting phrase over and over. Before anyone could process what he was saying, Devin suddenly fled the scene, leaving the manager and others in a state of disbelief. Shaken by Devin's peculiar outburst, the manager decided to enter the apartment, accompanied by maintenance for safety. The moment they opened the door, they were hit with a rancid smell so overwhelming it made them recoil. Inside the bathroom, they found the origin of the stench, a badly decomposed body lying on the floor. At first glance, it was hard to tell if it was even human. The advanced state of decomposition made it difficult to identify it, but it was clear the remains had been there for a long time, weeks, or even months. The police were called immediately and the entire building was taped off as detectives began their investigation. Inside the bathroom, authorities worked to reconstruct the events that had transpired. The body was found lying on its back, atop a pile of laundry and a partially torn Bible. The decomposition was so severe that determining the exact cause of death was difficult. However, the injuries told a story of unimaginable violence. The head had been dismembered and showed signs of blunt force trauma. There were multiple stab wounds, and the body had been impaled with what appeared to be a broken mop handle. Just as Devin had described, the body had no face. The damage was so extensive that positive identification would take time. But given the circumstances, detectives were almost certain the remains belonged to Veronica Jones. As detectives combed through the grim scene in the apartment, their investigation began to reveal a chilling story. Next to the body in the bathroom, detectives discovered what they believed to be the murder weapon, a metal leg from a table, stained with blood and strands of hair. Elsewhere in the apartment, more unsettling items came to light. By the front door, they found a knife, but oddly, no blood was detected on it. Near the bedroom, they located a mop head with the handle missing. That handle was still lodged inside the body, adding another layer of brutality to the crime. The apartment itself was in complete disarray. The floors and walls were damaged. The kitchen was littered with open cans of food, and insects swarmed both the kitchen and the bathroom. Despite the chaos, detectives found evidence suggesting that Devin had made feeble attempts to mask the smell and conceal the presence of the body. Open windows, two cans of air freshener, a can of Raid, the distinct odor of bleach and peroxide in the bathroom, and an empty flytrap container were found near the body, alongside other items. These makeshift efforts to control the odor and insects only underscored the horror of the scene. The discovery of these items painted a grim picture, one of neglect, desperation, and a crime that had been hidden in plain sight for far too long. The detectives immediately called Isaac to deliver the gut-wrenching news. Devin had been living with Veronica's decomposed body in the apartment for the past 6 months. But the big question remained. Did Devin kill her? During that time, Devin was reportedly arguing with Veronica, having full-blown conversations with her, even as she lay lifeless. Was this the result of disassociation from a traumatic event, or was it denial born from guilt after a brutal attack? In his eerie rant to the apartment manager, Devin seemed to suggest that someone else had attacked Veronica. Could he have discovered her after a deadly confrontation with their neighbor Chris? Or was this just another attempt to deflect blame? Detectives knew they couldn't dismiss any suspects yet, but their priority was clear: finding Devin. After his outburst with the manager, Devin ran from the apartment and disappeared. While they weren't certain he was responsible for Veronica's death, his erratic behavior made him a danger to himself and others. Detectives issued a bolo, determined to get him off the streets. Isaac, meanwhile, was already bracing for the worst. He had seen the news, cameras aimed at his sister's apartment building, and instinctively knew what had happened. "I didn't need anyone to tell me. I already knew what was going on," Isaac said. It wasn't long before Devin was spotted by a citizen on a street corner, just a few blocks from the apartment. Officers quickly apprehended him and brought him into custody. After escorting him into an interrogation room, Devin agreed to give a statement. He quickly confirmed that the body in the apartment was Veronica Jones, saying she had lived there with him and that he absolutely loved her. But then, Devin's tone darkened. "She just made me upset," he admitted. "She kept seeing other people." To detectives, it sounded like the beginning of a confession. "Upset you enough to kill her?" the detective asked. Devin said, "No, I didn't kill her. I loved her." "Then who did?" said the detective. "Kirby." "It was Kirby," said Devin. The name Kirby caught detectives off guard. It was a name they hadn't heard before, and Devin's response only became more incoherent. With no further information forthcoming from Devin, the officers ended the interview and turned to his sister, Tamika, seeking to gain more insight into the mysterious Kirby. According to Tamika, Kirby wasn't real. Devin had created him as part of the auditory hallucinations he'd experienced since his teenage years. Devin was diagnosed with schizophrenia in 1992 and had been in and out of state hospitals ever since. His struggles with mental illness were severe, and some of his past incidents involved violence, including choking a former girlfriend until she lost consciousness. But as troubling as Devin's past was, it was nothing compared to the horrors he inflicted on Veronica. The autopsy revealed Veronica had suffered more than 20 blows to the head with a metal table leg. She had been stabbed 32 times, endured impalement with a sharp, broken mop stick, and left to decompose for months. The state of decomposition was so advanced, she had to be identified through dental records. The medical examiner determined that Veronica's ultimate cause of death was a combination of all of her injuries. While pathologist Bennett Omalu could not establish the exact order in which the attacks occurred, he confirmed that she was alive throughout the ordeal. Defensive wounds showed that she had fought for her life during the torturous assault, emphasizing that she had been brutally tortured until her death. The brutality of the crime left no doubt. Veronica had suffered at the hands of someone she trusted. Now detectives faced the challenge of determining whether Devin's mental illness explained his actions, or if it was simply a convenient excuse for an unforgivable crime. Devin's first appearance before a judge was chaotic and erratic, prompting the judge to order a psychological evaluation. According to Veronica's family, Devin appeared to be putting on a show, trying to convince the court that he had completely lost touch with reality. But the evaluation revealed a different story. While Devin had been diagnosed with schizophrenia, the experts concluded that his condition didn't impair his ability to distinguish right from wrong. Based on the findings, the judge declared Devin competent to stand trial. In December 2012, a year to the day since Veronica's remains were found, Devin's trial began. Prosecutors focused on Devin's own statements to police, painting a picture of jealousy and control that ultimately led to Veronica's brutal death. They argued that Devin was jealous of the attention Veronica gave to other men, particularly Chris, the neighbor downstairs. That jealousy boiled over into rage, leading Devin to torture and bludgeon Veronica to death. Prosecutors emphasized Devin's calculated efforts to conceal the crime. His use of bleach, Raid, air fresheners, and opening windows to mask the smell, and his 6-month campaign to keep others out of the apartment. These are not the actions of a man who doesn't know right from wrong. These are the actions of a man trying to hide his guilt, prosecutors asserted. When the defense had the opportunity to present their case, they took the opposing stance. They claimed that Devin's decision to live in the apartment for 6 months, sharing the space with Veronica's decomposing body in the only bathroom, was proof of his insanity. But in the end, the jury found the prosecution's argument far more compelling, with all the evidence ultimately leading back to Devin. The jury found Devin guilty on all charges, including murder with special circumstances, torture, sexual assault with foreign object, and domestic violence. During the sentencing phase, Veronica Jones's family chose not to provide victim impact statements. They declined to describe Veronica, share the devastating effects her death had on them, or express their feelings toward Devin Epps. "He didn't deserve to hear how beautiful Veronica was," her brother David Jones said. At the conclusion of the trial, Devin was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole, bringing a tragic end to a harrowing tale of toxic obsession and unchecked jealousy. For Veronica's family, the verdict brought a measure of justice, but it could never erase the pain of losing her in such a horrific way. What do you think about this tragic case? This tragedy is far worse and more devastating than I can put into words on this platform. With each detail uncovered in my research, my shock and disgust deepened. To call Devin a monster, given the horrors he inflicted on Veronica, would be an understatement. It is a case that highlights the devastating consequences of jealousy, control, and untreated mental health issues. Devin Epps's actions were fueled by a combination of possessiveness and unresolved personal struggles. While his schizophrenia played a role in his behavior, the prosecution argued that his attempts to conceal the crime demonstrated an awareness of guilt and accountability. Veronica Jones's story is one of heartbreak, resilience, and unimaginable tragedy. She was a woman who faced incredible odds throughout her life. She deserved more from those around her, from the systems meant to protect her, and from life itself. Yet, despite the difficulties she endured, Veronica worked tirelessly to rebuild her life and reconnect with her family. Her journey, filled with both struggles and hope, was cruelly cut short in an act of extreme violence, leaving us to question how such a horrifying tragedy could unfold. Her story also brings to light the systemic challenges faced by individuals with complex lives. She was labeled transient, and her case was deprioritized early on by law enforcement, delaying the justice her family desperately sought. It's a stark reminder of the importance of treating all missing persons cases with urgency, regardless of a person's history. Given Devin's history of mental illness, do you think his sentence was appropriate? Or should his mental health have been taken into greater consideration? How much responsibility should be placed on the systems that failed Veronica, such as law enforcement's early dismissal of her case due to her background? Do you believe justice was fully served in this case? Why or why not? Let's continue the conversation down in the comments section below. As always, I'll meet you there. In these stories, there are no perfect victims, just imperfect individuals navigating different roles in life. Veronica was more than Devin's girlfriend. She was a loving daughter, sister, aunt, niece, cousin, mother, and friend to many who now mourn her loss. She will forever remain in the hearts of those who cherished and loved her, not because she was perfect, but because she was perfectly wonderful in their eyes. This is why I extend my gratitude to the victims for being beacons of love and light, despite any flaws that may emerge from their stories. So thank you, Veronica, for being an example of love and light. May you rest in eternal peace. That wraps up this episode of Sleuthy Stories. Thanks for joining me as we uncover the twists and turns of real-life cases. If you enjoyed the show, don't forget to follow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you have a moment, please leave a rating. It really helps more true crime fans find us. Want to see the visuals that go with today's case? You can find the full video version on my YouTube channel, Sleuthy Lucy. Check the link in the description. I'll be back soon with another case. But until then, keep your wits sharp and your curiosity sharper.